Hello and welcome to Always Take Notes.
We are thrilled to announce the publication of Always Take Notes, Advice from Some of the World's Greatest Writers. The book, edited by the two of us, features contributions from almost 100 past guests on the podcast. It's a distillation of the wit and wisdom we've heard over the past 6 years.
The book offers, we think, frank and entertaining guidance on writing in particular and living a creative life in general. It answers questions such as, where do the best ideas come from? How do you stay motivated? What does it take to become a published author? And how do you actually make money from your writing?
Published by Ithaca Press, Always Take Notes, Advice from Some of the World's Greatest Writers is available now in all good bookshops. We hope you enjoy reading it. Hello and welcome to Always Take Notes. In this episode, we speak to the biographer, Adam Sisman.
We spoke to Adam about his new coda to his biography of John le Carré, his early career in publishing, and his initial move into biography writing.
It's a great episode. We hope you enjoy it.
Adam, welcome to Always Take Notes. It's excellent to have you on the show. We wanted to start with your new book, The Secret Life of John le Carré, and particularly the kind of origin story of this book. So my understanding is this was born out of your 2015 authorised biography, but that you'd had a somewhat complex time writing that when le Carré was still alive. And then there was this idea of a secret annex of additional material that would be published posthumously, but that was actually suggested by one of le Carré's children. Is that right?
That's right, by his eldest son, Simon, who's also his literary executor. What happened was that while I was writing the 2015 biography, I started turning up uncomfortable truths, or truths that anyway made David. We're going to have this nomenclature problem because John le Carré's real name was David Cornwell, so I'm going to refer to him as David, but that means John le Carré, which made him uneasy, and in fact, more than uneasy, made him very anxious, and at various stages he was threatening to pull the plug altogether. And we reached a crisis point when his eldest son, Simon, stepped in as mediator and came to visit me at my home in Bristol, in fact, in the very room I'm sitting in now. And we talked about this all day. And he suggested that I should keep a secret annex of material that could be published posthumously, but not in David's lifetime.
I was struck in your original letter from him in 2010, when you approached him about the biography, that he said, oh, I have a bit of a messy private life. Did you have any idea at that point just how messy it was going to turn out to be?
Certainly not, no. And I'm not sure I know now, but it certainly was messy. Messy in the sense that I'm not a prude, and therefore I appreciate that some people have different kinds of relationships, different kinds of marriages and whatnot. But in his case, it was all secretive. And he kept it from everybody, including his, particularly, of course, his wife. And in fact, I eventually realized that the clandestine nature of the affairs was a large part of the attraction. Indeed, I suggest in the book that he was playing at spying, that when he'd stopped being, as he had been as a young man, a real spy, that he took up amateur spying. Adultery is a form of amateur espionage, if you like.
A point that we've had from other biographers on the show has been, to put bluntly, never write a biography of a living person, that it's just so complicated and that it often can end up in a situation like this. I think Maggie Ferguson, when we had her on, said something similar about her experience about writing about Michael Morpurgo. And we had Charles Moore on, he talks about the kind of quite specific but very clear directives he had, which was that Margaret Thatcher gave him access to the documents, made introductions, but it was clear that nothing would be published till she died and she would have no purview on the text. I mean, from having been through what sounds like a pretty complex process, what are your views on writing biographies of living subjects?
Well, I mean, I was in fact warned right at the beginning by Robert Harris, who had been in line to write David's biography before me, and he'd instead developed a career as an international best-selling novelist instead. So writing a biography wasn't a priority for him. But he said to me, you'll never be able to publish this biography in David's lifetime. And it certainly was touch and go at times. I thought that maybe I couldn't. Of course, and as a general piece of advice, you might say, yes, it's don't try writing the biography of a living person, particularly a living person who is as controlling as David Cornwell, John le Carré, and who, let's face it, has infinitely greater resources or had than I would have if it came to a legal battle, and much more power with publishers too. On the other hand, of course, there's a great advantage in writing about a living person in that you can interview them, you can ask them questions about themselves, how they feel about things. They can direct you to all sorts of sources that otherwise you might not be aware of, which David, to his credit, did. He introduced me not only to friends, but to enemies. Although not the ones that I began turning up that made him uncomfortable. So, I mean, it is very tricky writing about a living person, but it also has its plus side. And in fact, I had, and we may come onto this later, I had written, my second book was about Boswell's Life of Johnson. And of course, Boswell spent many years in the company of his subject, and although his biography wasn't written or published until after Johnson's death, it was much talked about between the biographer and the subject in the subject's lifetime. And indeed, some of the scenes where they're talking about biography actually appear in the book itself. So there's a kind of meta element to all of this, as there is, I think, in the new book.
You mentioned David slash John being controlling. In what ways did he sort of shut down or try and limit what you wrote?
There were two particular problem areas for him. One was his time in intelligence, working for first MI5 and then MI6. The other was his, as you alluded to earlier, his messy personal life. I knew that he hadn't been a faithful husband, but I hadn't realised the extent of his unfaithfulness, which was extraordinary. And in fact, I keep on coming across... I mean, one of the weird things I found when I was writing the book is that almost everywhere I went, I came across other women who had been involved with him. I mean, I went to a lunch party outside in the countryside near Bath, and somebody told me about a mistress. And then I late one night at a party where I live here in Bristol, somebody said, oh yeah, a friend of mine's mother had an affair with John le Carré, and so on and so on and so forth. I mean, only a few minutes before this podcast began, I got an impassioned message from somebody about another affair. It just, the story isn't, just keeps on going on, really. So there was that. I felt it was okay to write a book that was discreet and didn't cause too much distress to living people, particularly, I think, to le Carré's wife and to his children. But I thought these subjects had to be alluded to, if only in brief. And then I felt there was a story to be told after his death. And he did tell me, I don't mind what you write after my death. I just don't want this coming out while I'm alive.
I thought it was that there's that haunting passage in the book where you talk about when you sat down with David's wife and she gives this line, no one can have all of David. And you said it sounded like it had been rehearsed or that he'd told her to. I mean, I felt kind of huge pathos and pity for her, really, at that sense. But
that was the most horrible occasion. I felt that we were two puppets. He was manipulating us. He welcomed me into the house. He'd set up this meeting. He welcomed me into the house, and then he'd gone off, leaving the two of us together. I don't know which of us was the more uncomfortable, but I know I was very uncomfortable. And we were supposed to have this conversation about David's infidelity. And I felt we were just being manipulated. And as you say, it had been rehearsed. Poor woman. It was very difficult for her. Having said that, you know, she knew what he was like when she met him and she signed up for it. And I suppose she was a free agent. So I suppose you make your bed and you must lie in it.
And in terms of some of the women that he had the affairs with, I was also struck reading it that they seemed to be willing to talk and then they would have spoken to David and then it kind of got shut down again. How difficult was that to navigate?
Very difficult and very disappointing, really. I mean, there was one woman, an American photographer. First of all, I heard about her from David's sister, Charlotte, the actress. And then I contacted her and she seemed very willing to talk. And then suddenly I got this, don't contact me again, I don't want to have anything to do with your book message after she talked to David. In fact, she contacted me again just about 2 or 3 weeks ago saying, I read your marvellous book and when is the new one coming out? Of course, it was too late to write any more about her. But I mean, apart from anything else, I wanted to talk to these women because it seemed to me that for him, it was part of the writing process to have this kind of emotional catharsis, this kind of tension and drama in his life. And this, I suppose, comes back to the whole nature of the writing existence. Being a writer, even a best-selling writer, is not a very exciting existence. Most of the time, you just sit in a room and write. And he seemed to need a substitute for the excitement he'd found when he was working in intelligence and seemed to find it in these adulterous affairs. But I did come to feel that the women themselves were being used and that as soon as they took him seriously, he would say to them always, you're the one, I want to be with you, just give me time and then, you know, we can go off and live together and I'll get out of my marriage. But as soon as they came round, so to speak, he would lose interest very rapidly and cut them off.
I mean, reading it, I suppose, with a kind of cod psychoanalytical head on, it did seem like a classic kind of pattern of repeated behaviour that was causing enormous amounts of pain to people around him. And obviously he had this very disrupted childhood, you know, his mother left early. Did he ever seek therapy or any kind of, you know, professional help to unpack that form of behaviour, do you think?
Well, he did. He sought therapy in the 1960s during his first marriage, and I came across in his archive a document that I think he had forgotten was there, which was a long document he'd written about his sexuality for a psychiatrist that he was seeing. But he was rather snooty about the whole process of analysis or therapy. He was a very clever man, of course, and tended to think that he was cleverer than the therapist. And so he didn't really accept that he could be helped in any way. Alvarez's wife, Anne, who was a they were close friends in Hampstead. She noticed how sneering he was really about the whole process of therapy. And in terms of the kind of his psychological makeup, I mean, I resist too many making any kind of COD diagnosis. But I mean, he himself has one of his principal characters, Magnus Pym, who's quite obviously based on him in his autobiographical novel, The Perfect Spy, women are the enemy. And I think that's a very key sentence. He felt that women would always betray him, would always let him down. So what does he do? He betrays woman after woman and lets them down. It's a horrible thing, really. He realized that he was damaged, and he said at various times that I am the bridge which my sons must walk over in order to be normal.
And stories about these affairs have started to come out, one under a pseudonym, various other sort of whispers, and clearly it sounded like people kind of knew that this was going on. Do you think that his literary estate and family sort of wanted this to come out, you know, in a way that sort of preempted more stories from other people?
I don't know about preempting more stories. I mean, I remained in close contact with, I've been in close contact throughout, particularly with Simon, but also with his brothers. There are three children, three brothers from the first marriage and one from the second marriage. Had they been strongly opposed to the publication of this, I wouldn't have proceeded. Or had Jane still been alive, that Jane is the second wife. But on the contrary, Simon has been consistently encouraging, and generally says that, although he doesn't want to comment on it, on specifics, that everything relevant to David's writing needs to be known. And I think I've demonstrated pretty clearly in this book that you can't really understand David as a novelist, and the, both as the process of writing, but also what he wrote about, without understanding this very complex private life.
What do you think it's going to do to his reputation? I mean, I was struck by another line in your book saying that it's usually the biographer that has the last word. And I saw that William Boyd had also written a piece of the New Statesman saying he thinks that, you know, in the immediate future, that as more and more information about Le Carré's or David's private life comes to light, that will be the thing that he is, if not known for, that will in some ways eclipse the novels. How do you think this is going to play out over the years to come?
I don't think the private life will dominate the novels. What I think will happen is that there will be a sort of reckoning quite soon. I'm not the person to do it, but I think that people will reassess David's work and how important is he as a writer? Will we still be reading him in 10, 20, 50 years' time? And I think I would guess that the answer will be, yes, we will still be reading the best of him, but much of what he wrote can be forgotten. But the four or five best books, I think, will survive, because I think he's the definitive novelist of the Cold War. And I think he also understands the complexity of Britain trying to come to terms with the sort of post-imperial heritage, and all the kind of agony and pain of that, the long decline, which is something I've witnessed in my lifetime. I mean, I can still remember school atlases where a large part of the map was coloured red, and that meant they were part of the Empire / Commonwealth, and all sorts of astonishingly jingoistic books that I read growing up in the 50s and 60s, which no one would right now.
You mentioned the four or five best works in your opinion. Which are those?
Well, people will argue about their exact choice, but for me, obviously The Spy Who Came In From the Cold is an extraordinary book. It's wonderfully written, and it's the book that did most to change the perception of spies, and particularly of the sort of James Bond idea of the kind of macho, boyish, seductive spy. Then I think, A Perfect Spy, his autobiographical novel, Philip Roth described it as the best English novel since the war. And I think it's a very fine book. I think Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy is also a brilliant book. But much of what he wrote, written latterly, and certainly I think most of the books written in this century can be forgotten about. In fact, it would be a kindness really to forget about some of the later ones.
I found it very interesting when you were saying that, and I kind of agreed with that from my own reading of Le Carré. I mean, I remember first kind of encountering him in my late teens, I think reading The Honourable Schoolboy and thinking, like, I only understand half of this, but it's incredibly, seems incredibly sophisticated and so forth. And I also remember when I worked abroad in Africa, reading in a kind of season the whole of the Smiley versus Iskala, and then A Perfect Spy, which I also thought was amazing. And I didn't read any of him really for maybe 10 years. And in the run-up to this interview, I read The Russia House and I read The Night Manager. And I was like, they're either not as good or I have changed and things like that. But I also wondered whether he got further and further away from the world he was writing about, right? That in the 70s, he was only 10 years out of being an active participant in this. And that inevitably some of the verisimilitude and stuff like that began to go. And interesting, I thought with The Russia House, I was reading it, and although it's set in 1989, some of the vocabulary and the names seem redolent of, you know, three decades before almost.
I think that you're absolutely right. But it's also, so he's further away from that. Also, he's older. And I mean, some of the more recent books, it's rather embarrassing because he's writing about much younger protagonists. And he clearly doesn't understand how younger people live or how normal people live. You know, people, he has a young couple who living in Primrose Hill, for example, who are struggling to get by. Well, how are they living in Primrose Hill? And you know, he's not familiar with the world of computers and mobile phones, the digital universe. That's pretty obvious from several of the novels. But more seriously, it's also true that world of the Cold War is coming to an end as The Russia House is published, and then as has gone by the time of The Night Manager. And he always insisted that he hadn't lost his subject when the Cold War ended, but in a way he did. You know, he is the Cold War novelist. I still think that there are plenty of good things about The Night Manager and several of the other books subsequently, but they're nothing like as you know, they're not in the top rank.
Could we roll back now to your early life? Could you tell us a little bit about your upbringing and where your interest in history and literature came from?
Who knows? I don't know. I mean, what I can say is that from an early age, I wanted to be a writer. I just sort of liked the idea of being a writer. And also, I didn't think I was suited for most kinds of jobs. But I didn't know how to be a writer. My parents didn't know any writers. I didn't meet any writers until I started working in publishing after university. And by then I was already embarked on a not very distinguished career as an editor. I didn't start writing, in fact, until I got booted out of a job in the late 1980s. I fortunately was still quite young. I wasn't quite 40. And reassessed my life. And I thought, well, this is an opportunity to do what I've always really wanted to do. So I started writing a book. Sorry, as well as doing other things, of course, to try and put bread on the table.
We wanted to draw your attention to our crowdfunding page on Patreon. If you've been enjoying Always Take Notes, please do consider supporting us there. It helps us to keep the podcast going.
If you support us on Patreon, you can get a great selection of rewards, including a shout out on the show and a selection of successful magazine pictures. Thanks again for supporting Always Take Notes. We wanted to come on to that first book in a moment, but could you just tell us a little bit about what publishing was like in the 80s when you were working there compared to today, both in terms of, you know, how it kind of functioned as a business and then also what it was like and what you were doing as well.
Yes, well, I went from being a very, very junior editor to being what they called an editorial director in that period. I'm so old, I started in the mid-70s. I now realise I witnessed a very interesting time in publishing because I went to work for several companies that were family firms, where members of the original family, the Unwin family or the Macmillan family, were still working there, were still the family still owned the firms, and those family firms were quickly selling out. So did, you know, many other firms like Collins, for example, and becoming eventually, often in several stages, part of much larger international multimedia corporations, as most of them are today, whether it's Penguin Random House or HarperCollins or whatever. And this process involved a change of the culture of publishing. It was still pretty old-fashioned and quite tweedy when I started. And there was quite a distinction also between the business people and the literary people. And the literary people would usually, you know, some of them wore bow ties, that sort of thing. The business people would be, you know, playing with an adding machine or something. I remember being terribly impressed by that. Talking about percentages and margins and things I didn't really understand. And that all changed, and the distinction between editors and salespeople became much less apparent. Everyone had to be much more business oriented. But in a way, publishing slightly lost its soul in that process, and so one of the things I think that publishers have tried to do is to set up smaller units as part of these great corporations, and also there's been space for small companies like the company I'm with now at the moment, Profile, which has been enormously successful and has retained the feeling about being a small, friendly publisher while actually being quite a big hitter.
Much is made today about salaries and publishing and people starting out and whether they can make a living on on the money that they make. When you were working in publishing in the 1970s and early 80s, what was it like then?
It's still pretty badly paid. I mean, my first job as an editor, I got $3,000 a year. I know, it seemed, of course, that was worth a lot more then. But I mean, it was hard to live on junior editor's salary, certainly to live in London. I suppose that there was a bit of an assumption. There were quite a few people in publishing. This wasn't true of me, but it was true of quite a lot of people I knew who had some family money or something like that, some private income. And that obviously didn't encourage diversity or kind of inclusiveness. So I think many of the changes in that respect have been for the better. But I think it's still not very well paid. I've now got a daughter who works in publishing, and she struggles to make ends meet. It's not a way to, it's not a business to go into if you want to become rich, unless you start a publishing company. And in fact, in my time, there were several buccaneering entrepreneurs like Anthony Cheetham, for example, who started companies and then sold them again for what seemed like fabulous sums.
Could you tell us then about AJP Taylor and this first book that you published in the 1990s? How did it come about, and then what was that process of sort of poacher turned gamekeeper, of having been a publisher and then wanting to write a book yourself? How did that part?
As I said, I'd always nursed this ambition to write a book. In fact, the sort of initiating incident was that there were some letters of his published in the London Review of Books, in which he was sort of arguing with the then editor of the New Statesman, Kingsley Martin, about whether or not it was demeaning for a serious academic, a historian in his case, to write for the popular press. And he argued, it's quite ironic really, given that he was arguing with a journalist, that it was good to write for the popular press, not only because he was communicating with a wider public, but that it actually helped him to write more clearly in his academic writing. And I found this a very attractive argument, of course. I wasn't sure if it was true, but it became a sort of way into my subject. And I found with all my books that I need some kind of way into a subject, even if it's something that a theory that I later discard. I wrote about AJP Taylor's, what many thought of as his rival, Hugh Trevor Roper. And if you like, the way into that subject was that he became very successful as a young man on the back of writing and investigating Hitler, and then was brought low by Hitler when he authenticated some Hitler diaries that turned out to be forgeries. So he was made by Hitler and unmade by Hitler. That was, again, another perhaps simplistic theory that helped me kind of find a way into my subject.
What's the appeal in writing about historians in this kind of meta history biography form?
For me, or for the market, for me, I suppose the appeal is I've always been interested in history. I like historians who write well and who argue a thesis, an idea. Just take, for example, Trevor Roper had an idea about the Nazi state. He felt that the Nazi propaganda suggested that the Nazi state was very efficient. And he came to the conclusion that quite the contrary, the Nazi state was rather like a kind of medieval monarchy where you had a kind of all-powerful prince and then powerful nobles jostling position around this all-powerful prince, all kind of trying to get on top of the other one. And this led to great inefficiencies. But nevertheless, the propaganda was so strong that people believed this idea of ruthless efficiency about the Nazis, and Trevor Roper helped to challenge that.
One of the kind of fascinating points that we often ask historians about is their research methods, and particularly how they go about organizing and marshalling their material and then, you know, developing that into a narrative. And could you tell us how you approach that, but particularly what the difference between writing about, say, a late 18th century subject, so Boswell or someone is, versus a dead 20th century subject like Hugh Trevor Roper or AJP Taylor, and then maybe with Le Carré, where you've got a living person. I mean, tell us how your process works.
I think it's different according to the subject. I mean, for example, in writing about Boswell, although I did get the opportunity to look at some original manuscripts, that was really just a treat. I spent a very happy day at the Beinecke Library, for example, in Yale, looking at the manuscript of The Life of Johnson. But it's, I mean, I knew everything already. It had all been published. It's everything about Boswell and Johnson has been published in some form or other. And so I was able to work entirely from printed sources. And for that matter, entirely from home, if necessary. Whereas if you're writing a biography of someone, like I'm writing a biography of yet another historian at the moment, Asa Briggs, and I've spent an enormous amount of time in archives, including a month, I've recently come back from Boston, spending a month at Boston University in the archive there. He left at least four substantial archives, and then there's quite a lot of material in subsidiary archives, such as the BBC Written Archive Centre at Caversham. So it varies according to what the subject is. In the case of John le Carré or David Cornwall, a lot of that was based on interviews, extended interviews with him, and also with people that he knew or had known, but also in his personal archive. For example, there are 500 boxes of manuscript in the Bodleian Library, each of which I have gone through. And so, for example, they show that his original ideas for the Night Manager were totally different from the book that it became. Unlike some other writers, he just plunged in and then tried to find his way as he was writing. And I think I counted something like 17 or 18 different versions of Chapter One. There was also his personal archive in Cornwall, in a house, the house that's now for sale, and the archive's being transferred to the Bodleian. And it was in that archive, for example, that I found the document I alluded to earlier about his sex life, which I think he'd forgotten, and all sorts of other things, some of which he was surprised by.
And in terms of the actual process of taking notes, are you working sort of handwritten on index cards? Do you use a laptop? Do you sort of audio record notes? How do you sort of make sure that you have everything that you need? And then how do you go about organizing it so that it's ready to write from?
I'm terribly old-fashioned. I handwrite in notebooks. I don't know why. I'm a bad typist, I'm too slow really to... Although I have written, I think, about 1.5 million words that have been in print, I still type with two fingers. So it's easier for me to write in notebooks. The other thing is that when I'm taking notes, particularly notes on interviews, I'm not just taking notes on what people tell me, but also on what thoughts that occur to me as they're telling me notes, and indeed thoughts about them, which I might otherwise have forgotten. I don't say this is the most efficient way of working. I don't think it is, but it works for me. And I go back through those notes and rewrite them, make sure I can read what I've written. And if I'm not sure about something, I often then check it out. So my process is pretty amateurish, I would say. I was thinking about this in the context of your final questions, which I could come to now if you wanted to. But what I didn't do at the beginning, and which a piece of advice which I wish I'd had, was to note my sources properly. And I found, certainly when I was writing my first book, that I found myself having to go back to the original sources again because, for example, I hadn't noted the page number or something like that. And that was terribly laborious. And I thought, what an idiot I'd been. But then nobody told me. I had no idea. I've never been an academic. I just, I've got a mere undergraduate degree like anybody else. And so I was never given any training in research. I just had to make it up as I went along.
And when it comes to you know, moving from the research phase to the writing, do you develop a timeline and then work from there, or is it a more organic process?
I do develop a timeline, but that's really a reference tool. What I find is, this is in biography at any rate, which almost all my books are really, is that there's a sort of magic moment. and I can't really define what it is, but it is a moment when I suddenly feel I know this person and I know where I'm going. Because I don't think you can really start a book unless you know what direction it's going in. Of course, there's a chronological story. But if you're just telling the chronological story, that's a history book. It's not a biography. But I think you've got to have some sense of who the person is and what you... some feel for them. I mean, the analogy I sometimes use is of going into a darkened room from when it's bright outside. And at first, you can't see anything. You're groping in the dark, but gradually your eyes adjust to the darkness until eventually you can see almost as clearly as you as if it was lit.
Of all of the subjects that you've written about, were there any that took longer to see them clearly than others?
No, I don't think it. I think it just happens. There just is a moment. Of course, the fear is that one day you're going to be writing about them and you just won't, that moment will never come. Or you'll never develop a kind of sympathy for that person, or that you'll come to dislike them and therefore not want to write about them.
I wanted to ask, it's a rule of the show that we always ask about money and how it interfaces with people's writing lives. And you mentioned when we were corresponding before the interview that you've been able to sustain yourself as a full-time writer for the past 25 years or so. How has the whole financial piece worked? And be as open or as guarded as you're comfortable with, but it's something that we think it's useful for people to talk about and certainly, you know, useful for our listeners as well.
Well, I've written proposals for books and got my agent to sell them for as much money as possible, and then, you know, worked from those advances. And sometimes those advances have earned out, sometimes they haven't. But that's been enough to keep me going. And I think I've been pretty lucky, really. It helps, I think, as I said in our earlier correspondence, that I did work in publishing and I have a sense of what publishers like, and I know how to present things in a way that might interest publishers. Of course, I haven't been in publishing for quite a long time now, so I'm perhaps a bit out of touch. But nevertheless, you know, some of the principles remain the same. And you can present the same project in a way that will appear boring to a publisher or will excite the publisher. In general, I've been able to do that. I've had very few things that I've wanted to do that have been turned down. In fact, I'm struggling to think of any. There have been projects that I've known that I just couldn't get a sufficient advance for, which I'd quite like to have written had I had a private income or, you know, some other means of sustaining myself. But I've lived through this period when I've had, you know, young children and paid a mortgage and all that sort of stuff managed to keep going through that. So I would say that's a good news story for other writers. I think it is possible. I mean, all through, even from when I was working in publishing, and certainly when I started working in publishing, people were saying, I remember a friend of mine saying, it's closing times in the gardens of the West, very portentously, suggesting that the old world of being able to write and earn a living by writing was coming to an end. I don't think that's true. I think it's still possible to live by your writing.
Have you had the same agent since the beginning of your career?
No, I haven't. No, I changed. After the second book, I moved to Andrew Wiley, sometimes known as the Jackal. What had happened is my second book, the book about Boswell's Life of Johnson, won a big literary prize in America. And although it didn't come with any money at all, it came with a lot of prestige and helped me. It was my breakthrough book in America. And I felt I needed an agent who had some clout in America, and Andrew is based in New York. And I went to see him. He said, come and see me and let's talk. And I presented him with three ideas for a book. And the third idea, he said, that this is the least commercial, but I think this is the one that you want to write. And I'm going to sell it for as much money as I possibly can so that you can write it. And I really liked that. I thought that was great. You don't want to be thinking about money all the time when you're writing. You don't be worrying about money or trying to do other things in order. You want to just be able to write.
Another kind of point of this whole area that often comes up is about how the kind of royalty system or the way that writers are paid by publishers works. And we had David Baldacci, so this sort of gazillion-selling thriller writer on, who said that he came from a lawyer's background, and after he reached a certain level of success, he dramatically rewrote his contracts. He said he thought the royalty system was fundamentally unfair and that, you know, it didn't work. We've heard the perspective from publishers as well, but I mean, as someone who has worked on both sides of that fence, what do you think? Is it a fit-for-purpose system, do you think?
Well, fit for whose purpose, you might say. I mean, I always remember I worked for a little while for Annan and Unwin, which had an enormous success by publishing a work by a very then unknown Oxford academic who wrote a book about dwarves and elves that was called The Hobbit. And Annan and Unwin were so unsure about whether this could possibly be, well, despite an enthusiastic reception by the then 10-year-old Rainer Unwin, that it would sell, that they entered into a shared profit agreement with Tolkien. which was greatly to their disadvantage in the years to follow, because the shared profit meant huge sums going to the Tolkien and his family, which otherwise would have received much less in the royalty system. I don't know.
Could you just explain for people who might not be familiar with what it is, how a shared profit system works?
I mean, it basically means when the initial costs are amortized, everything that comes in is shared equally between the publisher and the author. I've never actually, as a publisher or an author, been involved in a shared profit contract. They're very, very unusual, I think. And it used to be true that royalties were quite a lot higher. That's another thing. I mean, some of David's royalties, John le Carré's royalties, were 17.5%, 20%. That just never happens nowadays, or at least not in my experience. Partly because the discounts are much deeper, that chains, online retailers like Amazon, and of course supermarkets, demand enormous discounts, so at least 50%. So it's just not possible to pay a 20% royalty on top of that. That would mean the publisher wouldn't have really anything left to pay for even the cost of production, let alone any kind of profit or contribution to overheads. So I see it from both sides. And in fact, David used to have a phrase which he got from one of his lawyers, which is always leave the other guy with a smile on his face in any negotiation. And I think there's something to be said for that.
You've mentioned that you're writing another book about a historian. How are you perceived by academics more generally in terms of your work? And you write for a more general audience, but also given that you also write about the academic world.
Well, I don't know if I'm perceived at all by academics outside history or intellectual history as well. I mean, I've got this nice relationship with St. Andrews, where they've made me an honorary professor, and they say very nice things about me. I think people are generally quite welcoming and kind, and I think academics much more appreciate the need to try and communicate to a wider audience, and writers who can take complicated ideas and subjects and manage to do that. Having said that, when my first book, as you mentioned, was a biography of A.J.P. Taylor, there was a woman professor writing a biography of A.J.P. Taylor at the same time. And she said, as a bit of a put down, my book is about the history, his book is about the sex. Which I didn't think was true, but actually I thought in some ways it helped sell my book. So I didn't really mind that. I mean, I've got quite a thick skin. If I'm disparaged by some people, that doesn't matter to me. But in fact, I've had some very nice plaudits and kind reception by people I respect very highly. Noel Malcolm, for example, often described as the cleverest man in England, has reviewed two of my books very favourably. So, you know, what more can one ask for?
I wanted to just come back to the John le Carré book as we come towards the end with a couple of questions. So the first one was this idea about his own career as a spy. And I was interested also in your book that it's pretty modest, right, what he did. That seems to be what you found out. But that also he was able later in life, when he'd acquired this kind of sage-like eminence, to sort of slightly retreat behind secrecy to give an impression that perhaps it was more than that. Is that fair, or do you think that's I'm mischaracterizing the point?
I think that's fair. He would like to say, I only had a very modest career, but sort of with a kind of indication that actually he wasn't telling the truth, that actually he was a sort of George Smiley in reality, and that he still had extensive intelligence connections. And it is true that he had some intelligence connections, but he wasn't really involved in anything important and wouldn't have been trusted by the intelligence people. I mean, I know that for a fact, having talked to quite a number of them intensely disliked what he wrote. So I think he would have liked to have been more involved after he left the service, or the office as it's sometimes known, than he was. He was always pleased to be invited back. And no, his career, he was a very junior, both in MI5 and then in MI6. But it was an interesting time, and he saw some interesting things. And, I mean, his career did lead directly into his writing. I mean, for example, his very first book, which is called Call for the Dead, the initiating incident of that is that Smiley has just been doing a bit of positive vetting of somebody who's about a civil servant who's about to be cleared or not cleared for access to very sensitive information. Well, that's actually what David was doing all the time. He was thought to be particularly good at positive vetting, perhaps because he had a novelist's in sympathy and understanding of other people.
I have two more, but they are quick. This is just my chance to put all my Le Carré queries. The first one was just on our money thing. How rich was he? And the second one is, you know, how much did his wife know about what was going on, do you think?
Okay, the first question, I mean, God knows, but I've seen an estimate of £100 million. I wouldn't think that's not far off. I mean, even back in the beginning of the 80s, he was earning about $5 million a book, sometimes more than that. And there were so many rights, his books sold all over the place. And then there were the film deals, you know, I think about a dozen films made of his books. So and television, as we more recently, you know, with The Night Manager and The Little Drummer Girl. So I think about 100 million. So how much did his wife know? She knew something. I mean, for example, I describe in the book a moment when she says to him rather angrily in front of a witness, "I don't want to celebrate your birthday with you if you're just going to be thinking about her," whoever the current her was. But often she didn't know. And he went to considerable lengths to conceal what he was doing from her. And sometimes, I mean, you know, there's a particularly odd example, which I think I highlight at the end of the book, where he's on a Greek island, supposedly doing something else, but in fact with his current mistress, and he's writing about Magnus Pym, who is after all based on him, who's also on the same Greek island in the same little fishing village, and he's with his wife, but in fact he's not telling her the whole truth. And David is writing about this while he's on the Greek island with his mistress, and then he takes the manuscript home and gets his wife to type it up. And there's so many layers there, aren't there, of deceit. It's wonderful, really, and yet ghastly at the same time.
Yeah, yikes. A final question from me would be, beyond the projects that are already in motion, are there any biographies that you hope to take on in the future?
Loads, the answer. I don't think I'll live long enough to write all the biographies I'd like to write. There's one that I'm sort of, I've been nursing for a long time, and I can't tell you who it is, unfortunately, but it would be a very big book if it happened. But there are other things. I mean, I'm always coming across things that interest me, and I've got at least three books planned in the future. So that should keep me going for some time.
Well, Adam, thank you very much for being a fantastic guest and Always Take Notes, and for indulging all my passion for John Le Carré / David Cornwell trivia, and wishing you all the best with this stack of weighty biographies you're going to write.
Oh, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
That was the Always Take Notes interview with Adam Sisman. He's not on social media, but The Secret Life of John Le Carré is published by Profile. Hello, it's us again. Rachel, what was your takeaway from the interview with Adam?
I really enjoyed speaking to Adam. It reminded me of the chat with Lee Child, in as much as they were both people that had gone into writing sort of after getting the push from another job. It allowed them to pursue something they'd kind of always thought about. And in general, I find biography writing really fascinating, and especially with a living subject and how you wrangle the material that's allowed to go in and in this case not, and how he then made a virtue of that with this new book. How about you?
I really enjoyed it. I mean, I was a big Le Carré fan when I was, I suppose, a teenager and in my 20s. And so the sort of chance to have a kind of in-depth Le Carré geek off was fascinating. But I also agree with you on this sort of thing of like the whole complexity of writing a biography of a living subject. And also, I thought interesting and quite heartening that he said, you know, he'd made a living and raised a family and done all of that writing his books, which is, I thought, was good compared to some of the sort of protestations of impossibility that we hear from some people. But I thought he was, yeah, kind of gracious and convivial guest. It felt almost like we were slightly, you know, doing two interviews, right? Because we were talking about the dead past spirit of John Le Carré and Adam Sisman. But yeah, it was a really good addition to have on the show. Anyway, Rachel, what have you been up to and what has your cultural intake been?
What have I been up to? Mostly
wedding planning at this point. I'm getting married in less than a month, so that takes up quite a lot of my spare time. But in terms of my cultural diet, I've been preparing for The Booker, which will have been announced by the time that this goes out. But I'm currently reading The Bee Sting, which is one of the shortlisted books, and I'm really thoroughly enjoying it. So if it wins, I'll be writing about it and you can hear more of my thoughts then. But yeah, that's me. How about you, Simon?
I have been busy with also another form of admin, and I'm traveling for my book in a couple of weeks and a lot to organise for that. But in matters cultural, I have been reading a book on the literary history of Switzerland called The Gilded Chalet, which is interesting. And then reading with my sort of usual magazine diets, I read three rather than two pieces over the weekend. So I read a piece that Christian Lorentzen wrote in Harper's earlier this year about the aborted merger of Penguin Random House and Simon & Schuster, which is very interesting for sort of people who want to know more about the business of publishing. And I also read a profile, Guardian long read profile, of Andrew Wiley, the kind of literary super agent, that was fun. And then a personal essay in The New Yorker about the whether AI is going to put coders out of business. Anyway, this has been Always Take Notes, hosted by me, Simon Akam.
And me, Rachel Lloyd.
Our producer and social media editor is Artemis Irvin. Our score is by Jess Danheiser, and our graphic design is by James Edgar.
If you'd like to follow us on social media, we're on Instagram at Always Take Notes, on Twitter at Take Notes Always. If you'd like to support us on our crowdfunding page on Patreon, we're on there under Always Take Notes. And if you'd like to leave a review on iTunes or get in touch with us via our website, please do.
Many thanks. Goodbye.